Hello, and welcome to the Track and Food Podcast. You are joining us today on a lovely Monday in Vancouver. I'm your host, Jamie Ma.
Snowy Vancouver.
What the fuck? Yes. I'm your host, Jamie Ma, and I'm joined, as always, with my co-host, Mickey McLeod. How are you today, Mickey?
Hello. I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. We are doing very well today because today we have a wonderful and very exceptional guest we are very excited to talk to. I'm Mr. Andrew Morrison, Editor-in-Chief of Scout Magazine. Hello,
Hi.
Andrew.
Hi. Whoop.
He's been doing a little bit of Alan Rickman this morning, so we're very excited to hear his voice.
It's my pleasure.
today is also a very special day because Mickey picked up a cute and lovely kitten yesterday.
Yes. Yeah. So if you listen to this show, or if you listen to our sister podcast, Beats on Repeat, with the talented and lovely Tristan Young, you know we have a podcast cat called Pete the Cat, kind of our mascot. Now there's a new cat, a kitten actually.
So this is going to be the mascot for Track and Food.
This can be Track and Food. This is Missy Elliott. I call her Emmy. And she's super duper fly.
Yeah, she's kind of the opposite of you.
She has no spine, though, I've noticed.
No.
She's just floppy around.
Yeah, she's floppy. Yeah. She does this thing where she like pushes up against you and kind of just like sits on you. It's really cute. It's adorable.
She's a noodle cat.
We'll put some stuff on Instagram.
She's 4 months, right?
She's 4 months old. So.
4 months old. Okay.
So it's a happy day. Very happy. So, except Pete is not super happy, unfortunately. He's being kind of pissy.
He's got to figure it out.
Yeah.
But today is also a very good day because all three of us did not watch the Super Bowl yesterday.
No.
Nope.
So, fuck the Super Bowl.
So none of us is... I'm a big sports fan. Mickey's a big sports fan.
Andrew, I'm a huge sports fan.
There you go. So none of us cares about football. I think that says something.
Well, none of us care about the Patriots, I think.
This is true.
No, I was happy the Patriots won. I don't care about football, but I like seeing Tom Brady piss everyone off. I think it's really good.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I went on ESPN
amazing.
This morning and there, the first thing that everyone's talking about is like, he might be the greatest football player of all time. And I'm like...
Oh, he's the best quarterback of all time, for sure.
He's the best player of all time. It's like unquestionable.
He's
now.
The best inflated ball handler of all time.
That
second
as well.
To Ron
he's got
Jeremy.
A lot of monikers. That's, yeah, Ron Jeremy.
Ron Jeremy. There you go.
No, I think when they came back against Atlanta, I think that was like...
Yeah, that was amazing.
He solidified it then. So this is just like... And already they were at the Super Bowl last year.
And he's married to Giselle Bundchen. So that's... he's living
I don't
a pretty
find her that
right
attractive,
now.
To be honest with you.
Well, I just think he's a douche.
Yeah.
What? Why? He is a Republican, though. That's he did support Donald Trump.
There you go.
So I do hate that.
There you
that.
Go. Perfect.
So there is that. But today we're very excited to speak with Andrew and talk about some of the stuff that he's been doing with Scout for the last 10 years. If you haven't followed Vancouver's food and culture scene, Scout Magazine is the preeminent magazine here in the city. I also contribute to Scout as
Absolutely.
Well.
Yeah, totally.
Andrew.
That's a biased opinion, but
well, it is a biased opinion, but I personally think it is. And I think if you're out there living in the city and you're going to ask anyone talking about this sphere, Scout definitely has a very good voice and they are very much tapped into a lot of the cultural consciousness. We're excited to talk to Andrew about a lot of his thoughts on how journalism is these days, how things are in Vancouver, Scout, you've been doing it now for since
2010
years. Yeah. Okay. So how that process has been with his partner, Michelle Spruill, who unfortunately is not here today, but I'm sure he can, they are married. So I'm sure he has some thoughts.
Partner in many, more than one way.
More than one way. And then, maybe shoot the shit as well. And then, maybe we can talk about
some other
things.
Let's shoot the shit.
Yeah, exactly. So Andrew.
Yep.
10 years.
Yes.
Scout wasn't your first foray into journalism. You got into it probably, 10 years before that?
Oh, yeah. It's basically at the beginning, the advent of the blogosphere, and things were just sort of getting weird. I remember this is a long story, but I'll make it short. I went overseas to study university in South Africa. And this is at the tail end of apartheid when Mandela was first elected. And I was studying history, and my goal in life was to be an historian. So I chose a university that was like shit was going down, and I was going to have a singular experience that I could then...
This would have been right around 94?
This is around 94 is when I went. Yeah. And when I came back, you know, my passion was history. I'm going to go... I went to the University of Toronto, was going to start working towards my master's. And that's where I met Michelle, got married. We had our first kid. The whole time I was working in restaurants. So I grew up working in restaurants. So I was back in the year 2000 when I was living in Toronto. We got married, we got our first kid, and I was working in a fine dining restaurant in Yorkville. And
did you start
9/11 happened?
Did you start as a dishwasher?
I started my career as like a slave laborer working for my mother when I was like super young.
Slave
she had a she had a chain of Italian delicatessens on Vancouver Island.
Oh.
So I was put to work doing dishwashing and
The only reason I ask is because that's kind of how we all started.
Yeah, common theme.
Yeah, common theme. That's,
but I was really young. Like, I was really young, like, after school and doing all that. But when 9/11 happened, and I started a political blog called Times New Roman, and it was about the American foreign policy response to 9/11 and how...
That's what you wanted to write about?
That's what I did write about. I wrote about that for almost 2 years. It was a pretty popular blog.
Well, first off, that's a really good name. Times New Roman. That's a pretty good name.
Yeah.
So I was writing about that and through a Canadian perspective. And then when Bush won re-election in 2004, I was like, I can't keep writing about this asshole and Donald Rumsfeld and like this scaly shit that was going down in, after the invasion of Iraq.
Can you still find this online?
I don't know. Maybe the old, what do you call it, Wayback Machine. Maybe we'll have some stuff.
But like, do you have much of your work from back then?
Or? Oh, gosh, no. No. And it's juvenilia. Like, this is stuff that I was writing in my early 20s, so it's guaranteed to be total shit. Right, let's be honest.
Let's be honest, yeah.
Yeah, so, but, I was so in love with the... I thought I was a genius, but no, in retrospect.
I started a blog back in 2008, my first one. I was like 23.
Was it a food blog?
Yeah, it was like, it was just kind of a whatever blog. And I called it Don't Get Goofy on Me because it was like one of my favorite quotes from the movie Ed Wood.
Oh, yeah.
And so I was just writing.
Jimmy's favorite film of all time, by the way, Ed Wood.
Yes.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, by far.
I found that out the other day.
That's interesting.
Intriguing, yeah. Very
intriguing. And so I'm writing this and I went back onto it like literally a couple weeks ago and I started reading like one of the first things I wrote and I was like, oh my God, this is so bad.
It's hard to do. It's hard to do, right?
Same thing with, I make electronic music and I go back and listen to stuff I was producing in like 1999 on Reason, like the very first Reason. I'm like, this is fucking horrible. This is terrible.
Well, I had before, when I was like 13, I started my first magazine and I had a little, no, maybe I was 14. It was a skate. I grew up as a skateboarder. I started skateboarding when I was 9 and got really into it. You know, the plan was to turn pro and stuff. I did it all the way until I left to go overseas to study university.
Nice.
So that, like, my brother was a sponsored amateur. He rode for Reel and Thunder Trucks and Spitfire wheels. So I was competitive, you know.
Oh, wow. But so it's like, yeah.
I still skate. In my last house in Strathcona, I built a 10-foot wide half pipe inside my house.
Wow.
Yeah, it was rad. But anyway, so I had two skateboarding magazines for when I was a kid, like using a photocopier and taking terrible photographs with a piece of shit camera. And, you know, so I've been doing that a long time, writing what I knew, right? So when Bush won re-election, I didn't want to continue writing about that. So I started writing about what I knew, which was back in the restaurant business. You know, I'd moved back to the city I was born in, Vancouver, and with my wife and our new kid, James, who's now 16, working at Les Amis de Fromage on Hastings, which is totally bizarre. But I started a blog called Waiter Blog, which was just about my life as a server. And it got really popular.
And at that time, that is a really good time to get
into
that
sphere. It was like super lucky.
No one's doing it.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I just come back from the Canadian Culinary Championships in Kelowna, and there was a conversation about the state of media amongst all the judges. The judges are from here all the way to Newfoundland and PEI. They're good friends of mine. They're top food writers from their cities, and like James Chatto from Toronto, Sasha Chapman, great, great people. But I only get to see them for a few days every year.
Yeah.
And every year we sort of have this. We talk about the state of food media and digital media, and
that's one of the things I want to.
It's a fascinating conversation because it's everybody that I would want to talk to, drinking, eating in the same room day after day, night after night. So it's cool. We always have these great conversations, and everyone was saying, you know, how clever I must have been to do what I do or did what I did when I did it. It was just totally luck. I just got lucky. Mm-hmm. You know, I started this blog when nobody else was blogging. The perspective from inside the restaurant was at the same time as like Anthony Bourdain was, where his stuff was starting to be valued.
Starting to take off,
yeah. So it was like people in Vancouver. And when I say people, I just mean editors and people in that trade were like, oh, this is interesting. It's a different angle. So within a week, I got offers from Van Mag and Western Living, and I was offered the restaurant critic position at the West Ender. So I was like, holy shit. super nice. And I didn't think it's not that I didn't think, I absolutely know I didn't have the talent or the experience warranting those kinds of, that would justify those kind of positions. But I was just super, super lucky.
Right place, right time.
Yeah. And I wasn't a good writer. And I'm still like not the greatest writer, but it's just the process of writing every day. It just makes you a little bit better. But that's how I started. I started another website called Urban Diner, which I had for several years.
I remember that one
with a partner. And yeah. And then I saw that the numbers, like the number of hits that we get every day would sort of flatline after a couple of years. Like we tapped out the number of people who were so just interested, who are food fetishists, who are just interested in food from an industry perspective. Uh-huh. You know, like there are so many other people out there because people who work in the industry aren't so one-dimensional as to only be interested in food.
Yeah.
So, and neither am I. Like I went to study history. Like I like music. I like art. I like culture. I like weird shit. You know, I'm not just down with food and booze. You know, I like to do stuff. And I'd be damned if I was going to corner myself. If I was in control, like it's my own company, I'm not going to say you're just going to write about this one thing. Like my favorite thing in the world to write about are things that I've just found out about like that day. You know, that's why we have like things like the lexicon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like these, you know, there's a column called Vancouver Would Be Cooler If, you know, just things that inspire me and teach me new things. Like that's what I find so rewarding about the whole job, more so than food writing. Like I love food, but it's so subjective. Like your palate is just as good as my palate, but somehow mine is valued more because I have a, you know,
you have a platform.
I have a platform. Like it's just such.
Well,
bullshit.
It's one of the things that people
trust me. Mine's not.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess what I'm saying.
Well, he's a vegan, so he doesn't really count.
Right,
yeah. Vegans really aren't real people. So
you bring that up.
You said that. You said that. But writing is a form of food. Writing is a form of entertainment. Full stop.
100%. I've had people ask me that several times because, like, since I've just started doing my own thing, they're like, "Why don't you do like restaurant reviews and all this stuff?" And I'm like, "Who am I to tell you what is?"
So we've
good
never
and
done a restaurant review on Scout in 10 years.
Yeah.
And I never will. First off, I find it boring. Like I'm like, there's very few people like Pete Wells or Jonathan.
You mean as a reader, you find it boring?
I find it boring
writer?
to write them and read them. I find it boring to do both.
It's hard to write them, but there are people that
Like Kevin Alexander did a really good one last year. He did like the best burger in America, and then he wrote.
Jonathan Gold was amazing.
He's amazing.
You know,
some people
Gill
can write
out
them.
Of the UK.
I can't
even
write
Alexander Gill. Like you love her or hate her in Vancouver. It's just she's a great communicator and she can put people in her chair and, you know, you have that experience through her. So a lot of people see the other thing is you can lose sight of what the food writing medium is all about. Not everyone can go out and afford to have like this great meal, you know, somewhere and have this glamorous evening out, and people can live vicariously through communicators like Alex Gill or A.A. Gill or Jonathan Gold. I mean, Jonathan Gold was a writer of the people, but
I love what he wrote.
Like how he changed the food scene in Los Angeles, but he also set a bar for this is what food writing should be. It should be about, you know, not the new sexy thing. It should be about the thing that you've never heard of. That's we have a column that's inspired by him called Never Heard of It.
Never Heard of It,
And the whole idea with that is I say to Fernando, it's like, just give me a restaurant I've never heard of before. Like Fernando Medrano is a great writer and contributor to Scout. He doesn't write like you, not as much as I wish you would, but you know, he's one of those guys that just has this, this great curiosity about food that sort of isn't common. You know, it's not the, he's into the ma and pops and the hole in the walls, the spots that don't get the love, that don't have like an Instagram account, you know, that don't have PR people and influencers hounding them. Like this is real stuff, ma and poppers. I love that shit, you know?
Well, I think a lot, I mean,
I think there's a lot in
a lot of people
the greater Vancouver area.
Dude, this is what Vancouver's food scene, you know, that to me is like the heart and soul of Vancouver's food scene, not the stuff that gets like front page.
Yeah.
You know, if you have a public relations person, you know, I'm not trying to diss public relations people because they definitely have
but they can pump you up.
They can pump a place up, and you know, there's nothing more disappointing than getting a 22 caliber experience out of a 357 Magnum reputation. You know what I mean? Like when you go into a place where it's been pumped up, you know, by by press or PR or their own hot air that floats their Instagram account. You know, you, when you like, I'm not going to name names, but there have been dining experiences that I've really looked forward to because of all the hype associated with them. And I'm guilty of hyping it up because that's part of what I do, is I always want to look and see what's coming down the pipe and help celebrate that as a possibility. Like look at what's going on. Let's get excited with this new place that's opening up. But when it, sometimes it doesn't.
Richmond's really good for that. There's a lot of really dope little hole in the wall mom and pop ramen places and stuff like that.
Yeah. We're super lucky for
that. Well, I was okay. So I went out for dinner last night, and you guys can, well, anybody out there can probably, who's listening to this right now, will be like, what place are you talking about? So I'm from Saskatchewan. So my family background is Ukrainian. Uh-huh. So there's this place on Robson and Denman called Ukrainian Village. And a lot of people don't know about it. It's just a total hole in the wall. And the food is not even like the best Ukrainian food you probably can find in the city. But I just love going there because it just kind of reminds me of my heritage. So I went there last night with my girlfriend. Literally cheap house wine. You get this Ukrainian dinner with cabbage rolls, pierogies.
Red or white.
So much food. And you get sausage, $20. Yeah. Literally, we walk out, our bill is like $35. And we're so full, so stuffed. You get borscht, everything. It's the best.
Yeah.
And so we go there and it's small. It's like, can hold maybe 20 seats. And the service is like, it's total mom.
Yeah, it's just like high school daughters running the place probably.
Exactly. And I love going there. No one knows about it.
It's been there for a while.
It's been there for a long, long time.
Yeah, that's the scary thing is how much longer can it be there in this current rental environment at Robson and Denman?
Yeah, like exactly.
And when you're food costing at $20 a plate, when you're giving a shit ton of food for that, that's like, okay.
Well, and the prices haven't really gone up since I've been going there. I've been going there since I've been here. So it's because I lived in that area for a long time. Yeah. So, and I go there all the time, and I always tell people, and people are always like this, like, what place are you going to? And it's like one of those things. It's like there's a lot of places like that in the city. So when we were down there yesterday, I'd been down in that area in a while, and I was walking, and there was like all these new Korean and Japanese places. And I'm like, what's this place? There's this one place called Saku, which would look really cool. There's this new ramen place. I was like, what are all these places? And that's exactly it. None of these places are being pumped up. None of them are being talked about that much. And there's so many of them down there that I was just like,
ramen land.
They're just relying on location, essentially.
Well, I mean, but they flip all the time. That's the one thing about that area, I will say, is the rent is so high and the turnover. And the Denman is like such a really difficult street to do anything on because your business, is a lot of it is relied on tourists in the summertime.
Oh,
and in the wintertime, there's a lot of residents that live in that area, but I've never seen an area have so much flip when it comes to restaurants.
But quality does stick there. I mean, there are like some restaurants that have been...
España's been there for quite a while now.
Yeah.
I mean,
Kingyo's
been there for a while.
There's Kingyo. There's
Nook's been there for a while.
There's, but it's sad when there are success stories that get hit with that, the lease is expiring and things are too expensive and they have to move. I think that was the case with Gyoza King. Gyoza King was like this legendary restaurant that back in the early 2000s, all chefs would go there afterwards. You'd go there and it was packed with industry people from like 11 until close at night. Yeah. It was just packed.
Everyone gets off work and they need a place to drink beer.
Ramen and drink a beer and scarfing gyoza. But yeah, that's one of those ones that I miss on that block. There are also Kintaro around the corner on Robson. That's rad. And they have a sister restaurant, Motomachi Shukudo.
Motomachi's, yeah, good.
Yeah. That's super awesome.
It was interesting. Reading your guys' restaurant graveyard. Mm-hmm. It was like a really interesting trip down memory lane.
Mm-hmm.
All those places in Yale Town.
I love that. Yeah. That's one of my favorite features on Scout because
Section 3. I remember that place.
There's no way.
Section 3 was really popular when I moved here.
There's no way that you can make money out of that. So my father was a publisher. And he used to, when I first started, he was like, the piece of advice that he liked to hammer into me, he was like, never publish anything unless you first wrapped advertising around it. Oh. Like such a shitty thing to say to a young, so I was like, fuck that idea. Like I've never once followed that advice. But
because your brain is like, I like this, I want to publish this.
Yeah,
why do I need money?
Yeah,
like,
So exactly. Like the restaurant graveyard came about because like, unlike art, film, good writing, music, anything creative, like once the creator is dead, there's even more reason to revere what they created. You know, like there are people who you know what I mean? Like you write a song and it's going to be there forever. You draw a picture, or you make a painting, or you create a film. It transcends the your lifetime. It persists, you know, as great art should. But with restaurants, you know, the money's over, the song is over, you know, you're done, you're out, and nobody gives a shit anymore. It's like, what's the new thing?
That's
right?
The new thing, yeah.
So that's, to me, is so tragic because in restaurants, you know,
Sometimes they fail. Sometimes they fail when it's not even their fault.
Sure, but that. But how many people got engaged there? How many people had, you know, how many people celebrated birthdays or anniversaries or had first dates or were introduced to a new flavor for the first time? Like the first time that you ever had an oyster or, you know, the first time that you ever ate something or drank something that just blew you the fuck away. And then the rent is due and they can't make it and they're done. And then a month later, something else pops in the place. And then Google, like now we're living in this digital environment where our collective memory as a species is basically Google. That's the arc. Noah's Ark of all our experience is now being Googled. We're Google sapiens from now on. So like about it. 6 months ago.
Why do you like that?
It's truth. It's the truth.
Yeah, but think about it. Back in the 1980s or 90s, even for that matter, like if you were the smart kid, it paid to be the smart kid. Because people come to you and be like, what's this? Now it's just like any dumb idiot.
It's just affecting like, different parts of your brain. Like our memories.
But the consequence is that without that, so if a restaurant closes, like this is actually a practical question for me as a content producer, is like, okay, when did I need to remember something about Feeney's on West Broadway? Rob Feeney's more casual place next to Lumiere. And I did a Google image search. Fucking nothing. Nothing in Google image search that would show me and maybe a picture, like an old shitty picture of a burger. Nothing that was professionally done or nothing that would give me a reveal of the layout of the room. You know?
Did you guys not do anything about them when you guys...
Oh, we did, sure. But it's gone from the internet. I don't know what Google did with it. But if you don't search for it for a while, it just doesn't give a shit anymore and it casts it away. So as a consequence, not only do you have the insult of this your what you achieved as a restaurateur gone, but the injury is that everybody's recollection of it is erased as well. So any sort of blog photographs or Twitter images or anything like that, if no one's searching for it, it just disappears.
How many have you done so far of the graveyard?
Oh, a couple hundred or maybe over. Like we wanted to start with like 60 or 75.
Do you have a favorite that you miss the most?
Oh, like for selfish reasons, but they're like, because I miss like a particular ingredient and I'd have to think that the burgers at Au Petit Chavignol, those are pretty good. I miss gyozas at Gyoza King. I miss the experience there.
This is going to stop.
There was some duck, hoisin duck pancakes at a place called Monsoon that closed on
duck main. Pancakes?
Yeah. Monsoon. See, it was called Monsoon East West Brasserie.
Where was that?
It was where Cafe Barney is, Southeast Main and Broadway.
Yeah. I think the one I miss the most is Bonita.
Yeah, so that goes without saying.
The original Bonita.
Yeah, the original Bonita, for fucking sure. And that just because it was a crew of good people, great people.
I just love that lounge.
Yeah, you sit at the bar.
Probably my favorite lounge I've ever sat in the city.
Yeah.
It was so
the
open.
First one?
The first one.
Yeah.
It was open, it was bright, bar was really cool. No one sat in the restaurant.
No, see, I always felt bad because for the cooks who are like, you know, if they wanted me to eat something and try their food, it's like, I'll have a poutine and I'll have a beer. A Sapporo poutine and I'll hang out for 4 hours.
Yeah. Exactly. No one sat in that restaurant. It was, I just love going there.
I was the worst customer there, but I was a regular.
Yeah. It was the first time I ever had a Sazerac.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Special memory for you then. Yeah. Well, you worked at Chill Winston, which closed down.
Yeah, I mean, like, I was going to say...
I worked at Santa Fear, which is Global Group, which shut down. Yeah. Which I had someone tell me the other day. I was like, I worked at Santa Fear. I was with Global for 2 years. Mm-hmm. Like, that place was really ahead of its time. I'm like, was it?
It was. On Granville Street, for sure. You know what's funny? I was going through my resume recently, just because I was changing some things. Every restaurant that I've worked at in the past is closed, except the Earl's in Saskatoon.
Oh.
There's like eight restaurants, all gone. I was like, do I still put these on my resume?
They can't actually call, so it's perfect.
I was just like, they're all gone.
Well, it's not if you're, they did have the dining beds, which was interesting, their cuisine, but it's global, so it's all pumped up.
Yeah, but you might as well just call those like semen beds.
Semen depositories?
I just can't imagine.
Well, I was a manager at the time, and I made sure Noe was having sex in those beds when I was there. That's for sure.
Yikes.
When I was gone, I don't know.
I think I did a Food Network thing with those guys. Like I did the opening soon. I used to be their man in Vancouver.
Yeah, they were on opening soon. Yeah, so Shannon.
Yeah, that's right. I walked around. I showed them around the restaurant and stuff.
Interesting.
Yeah. No, but I kind of miss Chill Winston, just their hub in Gastown. Yeah. I haven't been to local since. I've been to local once since it's open. Yeah. It's fine.
Local. But let's go to local.
I'm just thinking, if you're in Gastown, it should be the Reserve of Independence.
Yeah,
it should not chains or
and I've
chain, that's my opinion.
I wrote about
I agree
it.
100%.
There should be one little place in the city that all the big chain restaurants just can't come and play and fuck around.
And I've wrote about it and I talked to Jordan about it and I understand the reason why they got out of the business and they got 12 offers and he actually tried his best to take the least painful offer for the area because he's also part of the bid.
And they're not the first ones to do that because there's some people that have turned around some good landlords that have said no to big money to keep chains out.
He told me his best offer
I can't tell you who, but
that's good though. I like that.
His best offer, he told me it was Boston Pizza.
Awesome.
And they didn't take it because he didn't want that in the area. Oh, and I respect
that's
him
amazing.
So much for that.
That's
I respect
Boston Pizza locally, isn't that Donnelly Group?
It was Donnelly, yeah. He said he couldn't do it. And they were the biggest offer. He said they turned down that. Mm-hmm. And I respect him and Sonia for that big time. I mean, local for what they are, I don't have much to complain. I mean, they are kind of like the least worst of that kind of thing. But
isn't
and
it Joey's though?
It's
all
Joey's.
Fuller's. It's the Fuller Brothers.
But it's still, I'm sure the people that go there and it's fine. It still kind of caters to the same kind of crowd, the tourist crowd.
The food is fucking horrible. And the beer list is terrible.
And Chilwinson had its issues. I'm not exclaiming all that, but I don't know. Chilwin said it this kind of neighborhood feel to it for some reason.
Yeah.
And I probably know it better than most because I worked there for 3 years, but there was kind of some small semblance of a kind of community of local people that kind of liked going there. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I kind of miss that. You know, I think Portside probably picked it up a little bit. I think they probably still get a little bit of that, but like,
is that like a college bar though, Portside?
But one thing that Chilwinson kind of had was it was one of the few places in that area that it was like kind of you go for lunch and just kind of hang out.
Right.
Whereas there's a lot, not a lot of that in that area, like where it's kind of like a fun place.
Open for lunch.
Yeah, but like you can go there at 3 o'clock and go there for a beer. Mm-hmm. And it was just kind of like a nice place you can go inside, whether it was a winter or summer.
Yeah, and a long time ago too. See, Gastown's a completely different animal now than it was.
How has it changed since then?
Well, rents for one. It's a prohibitive, cost prohibitive environment. And also I think the clientele, you know, has changed considerably. Yeah. People are more willing to, now Gastown is seen as a dining destination, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
In a sense that it never used to be, you know. Oh, that's not true. It used to be like in the 1960s and 70s.
Right.
But, you know, John Bishop used to, of Bishop's Restaurant, got his first job in Vancouver cooking in a place. I think it's exactly where Chilwinson used to be.
Yeah, because it used to be a Greek restaurant before.
And then something way before that.
Before that, probably.
Yeah. See, this is why the restaurant graveyard is, to me, important, is that you can have a linear history of a particular address and you can actually go back and see like what used to be there. There are some places in Vancouver that in the last 10 years have had 5 different restaurants in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's always my biggest thing when I see a restaurant doing that. I mean, it's like, are you going to get any of that stink?
No,
you know,
you're not. See, you're good and think of Bonita, when Bonita opened at One West Cordova in Gastown, 3 other restaurants had been in that location in the previous 2 years.
Three and two years.
Oh, Jesus.
So, you'd think, oh shit, that address is totally doomed.
But some addresses are doomed.
Well,
there's one that you cite quite often, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I went to it. I mean, I don't want to.
Oh, come on, do it. In for a penny.
No one's going to listen to this.
No.
What am I doing here?
No, we talked about it, and I'm friends. I was just there the other day, Vare.
Yeah.
That location on Denman.
Which used to be...
It's been like 7 locations, 7 in different restaurants over the last little while. I went there this weekend, actually, and they were fucking packed for Dine Out.
Awesome.
And Matthew Fiddler is a good friend of mine. He was a GM at Taco Fino for a long time, and we worked together at Chilwinson. And I met the owner and the chef there, and his name is Chris, I think of what it was. But I really liked what they were doing there. I think they're going to be a really good restaurant. I think that area specifically actually needs something like that. It's a little bit higher end and it's good quality. And it the service was really good. The food was awesome. And they had a really good buzz about them. And I know it's Dine Out, so that's probably a different feeling. But
they're going to be busy in summer.
But I mean, that location, it's kind of hidden. So,
it is kind of hidden. But then again, so is C Restaurant and New Restrant.
Yeah,
of course, neither of them are there anymore. But do you get my point? Like, think of where Vidges used to be.
Or Savio Volpe.
And where Savio Volpe is a great example.
Middle of nowhere.
You get the people, you get the right people in the right place and you promote it properly and you deliver on the 4 cardinal points of a restaurant experience. Food, service, atmosphere, and the perception of value. If you can nail all 4 of those and you don't succeed, something is wrong with the city, not you.
Yeah.
You know, so when a place closes in that look, like there were Sunbelt Cookery, Gord Martin's place or whatever, like that Changes, I think was another name for a restaurant that was in that spot where Vera is now. those were all flawed concepts, and
but
know,
I agree with you.
If not you, the greatest, you know, collection of people. Not the greatest promotion. You know, there's another one, 350. Oh gosh, what is that? Thurlow, where Corner Suite Bistro Deluxe was.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they even just gave up on it being a restaurant. It might just be retail now, but it was it was bad for year after year after year. That killed Dale McKay.
Dale McKay, and he went Guggenheimer. To Saskatoon, and
he's like, screw this, I'm done.
Arriving.
Oh, that's okay. Different. I think people in Saskatoon are a hell of a lot more welcoming of new people who.
Well, he's from there too.
Sure, but I don't think it's a favorite son thing. I think that in Saskatoon they're starved for restaurant experiences that are elevated. Vancouver, it's old hat. Yeah. You can open something ingenious here, and locals will doubt it. You know, it's weird because there's so much stuff going on here that, like, even you dial it back 10 years ago, the stuff that's happening now would blow away 10 years ago. It's, you know, the city 10 years ago. It's just that it's so common now.
So would you say the bar is a lot higher now for a restaurant if you're coming in and you want to? Okay, so prime example, like if you were a restaurant or a person who wanted to get into the restaurant industry right now, would you say? I recommend that you go more casual, or you say go higher end.
It really depends on who the talent is.
The talent is? Okay, because I was one of the things I found interesting is when I was talking to the guys at Vare, one of the things they brought up to me, and I know this is a big issue, is he's like, it's finding chefs is the issue right now, and finding talent is the issue.
Right.
It's finding really good talent is the issue. It's like, it's finding people that know what they're doing and people that can really help you succeed is the hardest part.
Are people going back east? Is that part of the problem?
Well, probably. Yeah, people are probably moving back home. A lot of people are probably moving back home to Calgary and Saskatoon and Edmonton and Toronto. I know a lot. And since I've been here in 10 years now, in the last couple of years, I've met and known more people move to Toronto.
Yeah, Toronto.
Than I've thought would happen. And a lot of people just move in there because the market is growing and it's a bigger
cyclical.
City.
Cyclical. They'll come back.
They'll come back. Okay.
You know, yeah, I'm not too worried. I mean, the other thing is that cooking is a tight, like it's so demanding on you as a person. And then if you've got a family, like forget it. If you've got, you know, everyone's got rent to pay in the city and it's getting progressively worse and worse.
Because taxes are going up 4.5% this year. 4.5. Minimum wage goes up again in June. Landlords are just, you know, food costs are going up. I can't imagine what it's like to be a restaurateur right now. And also trying to maintain margins of saying like, okay, so I'm used to charging $25 for my fish, but I probably should charge $29.
Yeah, and do the perception of value, like you said.
There are ways that you can, like there are all sorts of ways that you see them starting to trickle through now, like where you elevate your food concept, but you have
back the service.
You make it counter service, so you don't have
huge
all the
States,
floor team.
Almost every place is like that in Portland,
right?
And I know that's going to happen a lot more. And I know a lot more restaurants are going to start getting into the food delivery model, which is going to be another way for people to make extra
I don't
money.
Like that.
I roll,
Fuck food delivery. And I know a lot of people are depending on it right now,
but
you're not cooking, go out.
Yeah,
if you're not cooking, have somebody else like go and take the experience.
No, but I know a lot of
100%.
I agree with you. I've never used it, and I've never used it, but it's a growing sphere. And
yeah, but your food is not arriving at its internal
But people
its
don't
intended.
Care.
Yeah, because quality people are high.
Yeah, that's why
people are too fucking
or hungover
to go out because they're just fucking.
Well, we talked about.
Too many bong hits, and now they're like, dude, I don't know if I can even handle the people who work at Juke.
I know friends of mine that use food delivery like sometimes like 4 times in a day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, because they can't, because all your friends are potheads.
Probably. But it's going to grow up.
And they all have long hair, too.
Yeah. Like, I don't even know. If,
right,
like, Japadog, do I need to speak Japanese? Is this freaking. I'm just going to pick up the phone. And
I think it helps if you speak Japanese. Japadog, actually.
App. Yeah, just use the app. See, that dates me right there. I was born in the 70s. You have to pick up a phone.
Maybe let's do this one day. You and I. Well, I don't smoke weed, but like I'll come over here. We'll just get baked out of a tree.
I have a vape pen, though.
And then we'll have no food in your house, and we'll just see how
see what happens.
See if we're tempted to order out, order in, should I say, or go up?
Well, I usually have no food in my fridge, so that's perfect.
You'll order in. This is the problem.
See, if I order
when you
in,
legalize marijuana, you are killing the restaurant business.
But you know what? We talked about this on our last episode.
Make marijuana illegal again is going to be my red hat.
Nice. You're ahead of the curve on that one.
About this one. This summer, there's going to be a lot of people going, there's going to be millions of people going to the beaches.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can go to the beach and smoke a joint, but you can't have a beer.
That's going to change, though. That's going to change for sure.
Do you think they're going to change that?
Dude, you can go to the library, shoot heroin into your neck, and you're not going to get arrested. This is Vancouver.
But why is it that you can sit at the beach at Third Beach, I can light up a joint, it's totally legal.
Yeah.
But then I can't have
a beer. Because the government's trying to make money on it now.
This city's fucked up.
Trying to get out of debt, man.
It's not fucked up. It's not fucked up.
No?
No. Jerusalem's fucked up. Vancouver's a walk in the park.
Venezuela is fucked up.
Caracas is a shit show.
Yeah.
We're a show.
Guys, perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
I think that when you start taking away these pieces from restaurants in order to make them affordable to and attractive, if it makes sense, it makes sense. Like water, it's going to find its way to the sea, you know, like they had counter service in space. Like look at the cantina in Star Wars. They weren't waiting table.
Yeah.
They were the bar. You know what I mean? Like I know that's a weird, but we got used to it. The idea that you have to pick up the phone and call someone to get something done now is terrifying to a new generation of people. Like that level of personal attention where you're like, I have to go and make a dentist appointment.
I had a friend who disabled his phone.
Right, because it's scary.
He says he'll never call again.
Right. Think about it. How weird is it to be waited on? When you think about it for a moment, how bizarre. Put your millennial thinking caps on for a second and think about how fucked up it is that somebody pretends to be your servant for 45 minutes to an hour and a half.
Yeah. I've always thought that was strange, actually.
That is a totally bunk situation, and we just go along with it. And then afterwards, you're like, thank you for your service. Here's 20% of the bill.
That's why they're doing it, is to make money, right?
Right. But, I mean, why they're doing it isn't because it's to make money. It's because that's the custom.
Right.
That's the societal norm. That's what the expectation is for a generation or two or three of living people out there, is that is what a restaurant is.
But do you think do you think people could wrap their heads around the idea in, say, 30 years with our children's generation?
Very easily.
That would be walk into a restaurant.
Go up
everything's
to the
everything. No, but everything's already ordered on your phone or whatever. Yep.
You don't have to. Dude, in Japan, you don't have to deal
with
it.
Next, that's not why is that rocket science? I walked into Hyundai the other night.
Just push a button. On
last
the table,
weekend,
man.
I walked in on a Friday night at like,
it's the new burger.
5:30, like right when they opened, already packed, nowhere to sit, line up at the door. There's Jeff Parr with a clipboard or an iPad clipboard.
These are the guys from Annalena. It's their
new
joint.
Burger thing that's their location at on West 4th, and. Everyone bought into the concept straight away. It's counter service, but it's a melee because there's so many people. But everyone knows their role already. It's not rocket science. No one's walking in like looking at the ceiling going, I don't know how this works.
So what is it? There's no service?
There's no table service. There's no table service at all. You just go to the counter and you say, I'm going to get a bacon cheeseburger, fries, and a beer. And then like, here's your, you know, where are you going to be? And like, well, maybe over here. And they'll figure it out.
Yeah.
The onus is on them to figure it out. But in that onus is you're shaving off the wait staff, bus boys.
So here's a better question. Do you think people prefer that?
I think that if they feel like they are, well, yeah, because it's more casual, you know, and they don't have to worry about getting dressed up or being nice to the server or having to deal with another human being and maintaining a conversation with. Yeah. This is a weird.
But could you get away with that at, say, St. Lawrence? Do you think people would be okay?
It's different. That's a higher.
No, but okay. But I understand that, and it's different. But
yeah, they'd be able to if St. Lawrence tomorrow, if Highs tomorrow turned things around and said, okay, we're going to do this. Everyone would already know what to do.
They would know what to do. It's but like, do you think
look. Yesterday I took a plane ride. Right. I know I need to take all my belt off and the metal out of my pockets and declare that I've got no liquids over a certain number of ounces because that's the new normal. And we deal with it and move on and just try and make sure that no one beats us and steals from us and destroys us. That's our mission in life, is to make it through to the next day. And, you know, restaurant experiences aren't that crazy, you know, and static where they are immovable. They've changed so much in the last couple of generations.
Absolutely.
Like the idea of fine dining in Vancouver has just been basically wiped away.
It's pretty much gone.
Absolutely.
I don't think it exists.
In the old way, like the old French service kind of way, it's pretty much erased.
Yeah.
like even the places that are celebrated as the highest echelon of dining in Vancouver, they're chill. I can go in with jeans and, you know.
Makes you wonder if it'll ever come around. Because you know, when you talk about cyclical.
I think it would be a novelty. Like, did you hear about this place? And, you know, the waiter lays his napkin on or your napkin on your lap. And
you got to wear like a suit and tie type thing.
Yeah, and they give you a jacket if you walk in. Maybe. Yeah. Like maybe that if it was would be done cool. in a
funky way, maybe.
But it would be so Disney. Like people would be like, "Look what we're doing." It's weird, right?
Totally.
So I guess okay. So this piggybacks on a question I was curious to ask you. So you've been in Scout now for 10 years. Mm-hmm. You've seen the city evolve for 10 years. Mm-hmm. What is some of the things in this that have happened over the last 10 years that have kind of maybe shocked you or surprised you in the sense of like running, especially because you are in a very unique position because you aren't actually physically working in the industry, but you are so connected to it in a kind of a very kind of periphery way, which is really cool. But it's also, you see things from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. Have you seen the city kind of evolve in a way that's you've like, do you ever wonder like, that's interesting, or like, I like the way this is going, or...
Yeah, I mean, there have been changes that with the benefit of retrospect, you realize how important they were and how fundamental they were as course corrections, or not corrections, but just course changes in the direction of Vancouver's food scene. Like, it wasn't until recently that I think I fully grasped the massive change that the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009 made on Vancouver's food scene. I think that Vancouver's always been a casual city. You know, we're a relaxed city. And up until that point, up until that, like,
do you think it really affected us?
Oh, dude, hugely, massively. Because in the early 2000s, we started to really come to grips with who we were as a food city. Previous to that, we were really looking at what New York or Toronto or Montreal or Los Angeles or San Francisco, all our most famous restaurants were based on the cuisine of somewhere else. They were based on the model of somewhere else.
And developed our own identity.
There was no Vancouver identity. You know, John Bishop likes to laugh about like in the 1980s where, you know, I think he was working at the Yellow House or Umberto's Il Giardino. And, you know, the idea of having a local tomato or produce was almost like gross. You wanted to have it shipped up from California
so
or imported
from
somewhere.
Wasn't...
No, not at all. And he introduced, like, when Bishop's opened in 86, like, there were a few restaurants but he was the sort of evangelist who said, you know, he was like the guy who started pushing us in that direction. But what's important is he had staff that went on to move to open their own restaurants and be chefs elsewhere, or sous chefs or servers or maitre d's elsewhere, sort of preach that gospel of Vancouver to other restaurants. So you had this new wave of young restaurateurs who, like, everyone is sort of tangentially or connected to Bishop's in one way or another. Like, they would go and
did David Hawksworth come from that?
No, but he worked for, you know, he's on a mission, but like Rob Feeney did.
Rob Feeney, yeah.
For a very short period. Vikram Vij did. Anyway, my point is that right in the early 2000s, we were really starting to find our stride in that new generation of restaurateurs that were sort of trained in celebrating the local and building relationships with farmers and, you know, like the Jeff Van Geese and the Curtis Colts who had Aurora Bistro on Main Street. That was an all BC wine list, all local food thing in the mid 2000s. It's not there anymore. It's now Wallflower Cafe, but, you know, Curtis has gone on to to do really well with the Georgia Strait and be a great wine communicator and an ambassador of the Okanagan and the value of BC wines. And Jeff is, you know, who was a sous chef or a chef de cuisine for Bishop, has gone on to Miradoro and the Okanagan, and he's spreading the gospel in the Okanagan about local food, where previously it was kind of anathema. Like, they were looking to everyone else, like, what should we do? Well, do what you should do from the Okanagan with the stuff that you got right there. You know, so it got to a point where, you know, in 2008 and Vancouver was becoming very much its own thing. It was attracting the likes of a Jean-Georges Van Gerichten or a Daniel Ballou who'd come and open, you know, market in the Shangri-La or DB Bistro or take over the reins from Rob Feeney at Lumiere. And then the financial crisis happened. And those weren't the only casualties. Like DB Bistro and Lumiere weren't the only casualties. It was like Fuel that was owned by Robert Belcham and Tom Dowdy, who were, you know...
They had to redo it as Refuel, I think, afterwards.
They did.
They had to rechange it.
You know, and Angus Ann, who was at previously, I think he was at Lumiere not a sous, but like, I can't remember. But he had Gastropod, which became Mainom. And the chef, J.C. Poirier, at St. Lawrence now in Porthouse and Asked for Luigi and Pizzeria Farina, he had Chow on South Granville. And all these boom, 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 they shuttered. And they're almost like a shellfish. They just like closed up on themselves and
DB Bistro Deluxe is basically an amalgam of all that. Because it was kind of, they were trying to do something really high end, and they just died quickly.
They died, well, they lasted longer, I think, than those others.
Yeah.
But very quickly, it sort of shrunk the nutsacks of these, no offense, that's a terrible... terrible visual, but you know, all those places went casual or they closed, you know? So if you're a young restaurateur, like think of Robert Belcham is an incredibly talented guy who opened new to thunderous applause, who was at C restaurant, who's trained by the best of the best and has worked with the best of the best. And now, you know, Campagnolo Roma is closed. Refuel is closed. He's got, you know, Campagnolo. And Modern Burger, the Dirty Burger. What's the name of the American bar where I can't remember what they're branding it as the American
Monarch
bar?
Monarch
Burger, sorry. Monarch Burger. So burgers and pizza versus what he used to do.
But that's what sells now. That's what's unfortunate.
Well, it's not that it's delicious stuff. I'm just saying that had that financial crisis not happened, we would have Angus Ann, like the Mainom is the best Thai food in Canada, I think, bar none. Would we still be enjoying, you know, the stuff that he would create at Gastropod with some next level shit, you know? And Robert Belcham, what he and Tom were doing at Fuel was really, really interesting. It was just the beginning too. Like we were just starting to see a generation of young restaurateurs swing for the fences.
So you feel like now for a good 10 years that we took a big step back.
I think that we stepped back, and then that step where we stopped
and
is things have calcified. Things have sort of stopped, and because of the you know, the consequences of the financial crisis is that like the rich got richer but the middle class shrunk, you know,
and rent is exorbitant
and gone insane.
So taking a risk on something like that right now would be very difficult.
Right. So things have sort of there's been this, restaurateurs are having to play with a status quo that is getting more and more difficult. The margins are tighter. Beyond that, like the knowledge of the customer base is deep and broadened, and you know, they want more value for less money.
Everyone's an expert now.
Well, I'm saying
this. Everyone's an expert. This all coincides with the total collapse in how traditional legacy media is valued. No one gives a shit anymore. Yeah. Like outlets are like, I was a restaurant critic for the West Center for 5 years. I left there like, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, but or it's probably longer, and I'm just clutching, but that newspaper is gone. You know, there is very little in the way of real restaurant criticism or food writing anymore. It's sort of been overrun by influencers, people who can take a good picture, and everything is delicious. Everything is
that word influencer.
You know, everything is. No one's really taking a critical, deeper approach. They're just sort of scratching the surface, and they have to do it instead of once a week. You know, once a day. And it's kind of this big reach around of, you know, I get food for free and I take a picture of you and I celebrate it. Everyone gets more followers and then begin again. And we do it again and again and again and again. And it's just, what does the media consumer get out of that? Where does the food city go as a result of that? It just treads water.
That was actually going to touch on one of the questions I was going to ask you, is like running a media platform that you do with Scout and hearing stuff like with BuzzFeed happened with them last week, mm-hmm. and how they had to lay off a ton of cuts. And you see how all advertising now is basically on two platforms, Facebook and Google. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you're talking about exactly how the death of good food journalism and how people don't look for it or can't find it, or it's just not there anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's undervalued. And if anybody's even doing it, making a living at it is good luck. I mean, good luck making a living in journalism at all. And it's probably not going to get any better. When you run your, has that affected you guys in any way?
No.
No?
We've been sort of maintaining, in fact, we're expanding.
So have you found a way to navigate that? Like, what have you had any challenges?
I think approach works. Approach matters. Like, there's a guy, a publisher, editor, journalist in the United States. He runs a company called Talking Points Memo, which is sort of like, it's a great source for politics. Anything that's happening in the United States in the realm of politics, it's like one of the greatest sites. There's a paywall.
So it's like similar to Politico or type thing?
It's better than Politico. Okay. I think so. And it's been around a lot longer. So his name is Josh, and Josh Marshall. And he wrote something that I really found interesting recently. I think commenting on what happened at BuzzFeed and what happened at Vice in the last 48 hours, Vice. You know, where it just they're hemorrhaging jobs and money. And it's important to remember that owning a media company, people would own media companies for different reasons than they do now. It used to be that, you know, the Sulzbergers, the old sort of legacy media companies, it was because they believed in something. They believed in the value of communication. They believed that there were messages, that there were things that were not being properly told out there in the world, and that they wanted to tell them. And for them, it was a purpose.
Well, it's kind of exactly what the whole meaning of the movie that came out last year, The Post, was about the Watergate
scandal.
In
no way am I comparing myself and what we do to those guys. I want to be clear. But I want to say that I found that really interesting in that what Josh was saying was that those people would accept losing money to do their mission. They were super rich. They had other businesses, but they had these companies, Washington Post, New York Times, and so on. Because they believed in something fundamental about communication, that it was their mission to deliver the truth to people, like to deliver their message in their way. And that now, owning a media company, the motivation there is to make money quickly.
You're Jeff Bezos, you own Wall Street Journal, you will own the Washington Post.
It's about making a shit ton of money, and they're outside investors who don't care about the company or don't care about truth. They just
and also
get
getting
turn about yeah. they care about profit. We have never once cared about profit.
Yeah.
You know, that's why we do stupid things like Restaurant Graveyard. You know, ours is a kitchen table operation. It's Michelle and I, and we liaise, we talk with Jamie right here by email or by telephone, by text. I got a new thing. What do you think of this? A green light, red light, some editing guidance. That's basically it. Our mission is basically never changed from the beginning. It's to support and to shout out or to scout out things that don't get the attention that they deserve in the city of Vancouver and that mission has never changed. In fact, it feels like it's more important.
Have you
than
felt
ever.
Any pressure to, go in a different direction?
Oh, huge. Yeah. Huge. Like, well, here's
sellout, I think is the word you're looking for.
Sellout, but I mean, like, has, I'm sure you've been approached with people saying, like, I'll give you this certain amount of money to.
Many, many times. Many, many times. See, you have to think about who controls the purse strings of advertising in British Columbia and Vancouver. It's resource extraction, it's automotive, it's real estate.
Jimmy
real estate, yeah.
It's real estate. So you look at all the big media companies and where do all their operation dollars come from?
Well, who bought Van Meg recently?
Oh gosh, that thing has been sold so many
like four times.
Times
in the last 2 years.
Really?
Is it maybe the Yellow Pages?
Yeah, there was Yellow Pages. It was Yelp gum? First. It was Yelp and then Yellow Pages.
I think it's Bazooka Gum or Hostess Potato Chip.
Wow, interesting. I don't know that.
But yeah, I don't know.
Not the shit on them.
Yeah, well.
I feel for the people who work there because how traumatic is that? Like I remember when like Van Mag, or not Van Mag, when the West Ender let me go, I felt so bad.
When
like,
they're gone
I know, but still like from a from a
no, but that says a lot about that says a lot about the media. I mean, it's gone; it doesn't even exist anymore.
Yeah, right. So, but it was bought and folded into something.
And
else.
And I talked to Neil McLennan a little while ago about like some of the struggles he's had to deal with.
Yeah, I feel
as the
for
food
him,
as the food editor for Van Magen, like he just the changes that they've had to go through, and like I think he ended up stepping down as food editor. And now he's just kind of writing and still kind of runs a lot of the stuff. But it's like I can't imagine a lot of the.
But you know what, fucking Van Mag, you know, I've always had so much respect for like for that entity. But they saw the writing of the wall on the wall so long ago, like 2005, 2006. They had every opportunity to go digital first, and
yeah,
really,
and
they just slow walked the whole thing.
And they still do print, which is stupid.
Well, it's not that it's. I don't think it's stupid. I think that they could have managed it better. I think that they, but that neither here nor there. I think that there's a place in the city for a publication like Vancouver Magazine.
No, it's very important.
I wish them well. They had a huge opportunity back in the day, and they didn't take it. Like if they had taken it, they would have owned that space in the city instead of been on the periphery of it. Yeah. Which is, you know,
and I'm not trying to bag them in any way.
No, they're still
I like what they do.
They have a budget, dude. Like they could totally turn things around and make things amazing.
And they have a really big voice, and their awards are still the biggest awards in the city. I mean, people still love the Van Mag Awards.
Everybody likes a pat in the back.
Exactly. Even though the Van Mag Awards, I feel like a little bit are compromised in some ways. That's just my own personal opinion because some of the results I've seen come out of them. But that is my own personal opinion.
Are you insinuating?
Andrew's going to be mum on this one.
No, I signed non-disclosure agreements when I was a judge. They probably come after me. But I'm not a judge. I haven't been a judge of that stuff for many years now.
Well,
But so the state of media is such that if you can keep small and nimble, then you've got room to move laterally and make changes. But if you're a behemoth and you're stuck in your ways and you're stuck, you know, we've also got a really interesting, not interesting, but like a unique revenue model, you know, that frees us up to just concentrate on producing copy every day. We don't have to worry about. Like, this is the other thing. We've never once taken money from real estate companies, which is insane.
Have you been given
all the time?
Offered?
And I think now it's sort of known amongst people that we'll never say.
I wonder why they want to get in business with you?
Well, just to put, everyone voice. Needs to take their message to market, right? And if we've got young people between the ages of X and Y, then we're affordable, then it fits their profile. You know, but we've never once. If I can't afford to live in this city, fuck you and your stupid real estate company.
Amen to that.
Amen to that.
If I'm working my ass off every day and I have for like years and I can't afford to buy a house in the city that I was born in, fuck you.
And there's
stupid
a lot of people
media.
That probably feel the same way. And
yeah.
I kind of agree.
And
with
it, this is inside baseball. Like nobody knows this. We don't wear it on our sleeves that we don't. You know, we don't offer advertising to media companies. You know, we like to support the small and the local and the people who are struggling.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And also support the great people that are you're talking about. You know, like a lot of the great restaurants who want to, you know, if you put their ads on the website or you put that awesome brewery that's down the street and they get their ad on your website. I mean, that's a great way to do small, but, and I'm sure they're probably not giving you a ton of money or whatever. I don't know how their
your
model
if you
is.
Support something that's
you're not
a ton of money.
But what I'm saying is you're supporting a small business.
Yeah.
And a business that
you lose your
probably needs
credibility as well if you support something that obviously is subpar or not.
But it's like
good,
the thing
right?
that I always feel about, like when I see celebrity athletes like LeBron James and stuff like this, or even my favorite athlete, Kobe Bryant, it's like, why are you supporting McDonald's?
It's so easy to rationalize that.
But I mean,
stuff,
you're not
though.
Eating it. You don't,
money,
that's
man.
Clearly not good for you. Why would you support that? Why are you telling little kids to do that? So it's kind of like the same thing. It's like, you know, why would I slap a big real estate something on the top of Scout when. A, I don't support this company, and A, they don't support me in any way as an individual who lives in Vancouver. Whereas
I just think they ruined Vancouver.
Yeah.
That's all.
Whereas
I think that the greed ruined Vancouver. And there's no turning back. Like that's like I have black malice in my heart for real estate companies in the city, real estate marketers.
Absolutely.
In particular. Like people who are just like, no, it's not a problem. It's cool. Just chill, relax. You know, fuck you. Chill, relax.
Yeah, it trickles down all the problems that we have in the restaurant industry and
yeah.
affordability and everything.
Oh, well, we're all doomed.
Yeah. Jamie just wanted to get a Kobe Bryant reference.
Yeah,
know,
yeah,
just
sure.
So you know.
Yeah, that felt good.
Yeah.
Out of all the topics that Scout likes to talk about or you guys have as things, and I've worked on some of them, obviously, What's the one that you like? Like, what's one that you're most proud of? I would say, like, would you say opening soon would be the one that you're most proud of? Because I feel like that one is very resonant with a lot of people because it's a great
way. It's sticky with a lot of people. Because the opening soon, it's kind of like putting your balls on a chopping block and just handing somebody a butcher knife. I mean, that's because I think that when we don't put everybody on the, like, if you're opening a restaurant, congratulations. You know, not everybody makes it onto the opening soon list. These are the restaurants that make it on there are ones that we think have a good chance of being around, that we think that people will really want to go to.
Did they come to you or do you find them?
It's a mix of both. Like people will say, hey, I'm opening this thing. Maybe you're interested. And I'll be like, hey, cool. You know, tell me more. Who's involved? And usually it's if you know some of the operators, you know, if you know them by reputation even, but still, if I've never heard of the people and they give me, you know, they ring my bell, I'll still be curious. But I'll make a calculation as to whether or not, you know, I think that, and sometimes I'm wrong, you know, where we don't include somebody or, and they end up doing amazing things. But, and the other thing is what an asshole, like I had to put yourself out there as an arbiter of what's going to make it and what's not like that. I feel bad about that, but this is a list that like that we keep because we feel that there's a value.
Yeah, I get it.
If you just made everything, then it's nothing.
You have to have some sort of criteria. I get that.
Yeah,
that's fair.
Yeah, and it's a weird criteria. So I'm not especially proud of that because it hurts me. Like it sucks to have to pick and choose things, that kind of thing where you put yourself out there as an arbiter. I'm not comfortable with that. That I would say that I'm most proud of, like associating myself.
The reason I brought that up is I like it.
Yeah.
I think it's a really cool thing.
People really like that.
Yeah.
But I mean, from a personal perspective, as somebody who produces content, that's not my favorite.
Okay.
My favorite stuff is the more personal stuff. When my eldest son was, this is about 5 years ago, he got a copy of Fred Herzog's old photography book of Vancouver, where you can see what it looked like on the corner of Hastings and Carroll in 1960, you know? Yeah. So we took that book and a camera and we walked that book around the city of Vancouver, him and I, and we tried to line up exactly where the old photographs were and then take a picture, a side-by-side with what it looks like now. You know, for me, that kind of stuff is the stuff I'm most proud of, the stuff that's personal I don't like the restaurant graveyard. Like the restaurant graveyard is great because I have a really strong memory of going to a restaurant called Cosmas, which is my godmother's Sophie Dikiakos, who owns Sophie's Cosmic Cafe. And she's got relatives that are up in Penticton that opened Theo's. They're an institution, but nobody really knows this about them, that they had a restaurant in the 1970s called Cosmas, right by Umberto Mengi's sort of collection of restaurants on Pacific. And it was a big deal in the day. It was a huge deal. It was in National Geographic magazine, a full center spread of a belly dancer. I think my mother's in the photograph. And for me, it was like the first time that I ever saw a woman in any kind of state of undress. So it was titillating for me when I was 8 years old, you know, to have a belly dancer. And I still know that belly dancer. Her name was Alexandra. And I still see her, you know, at least a year, you know, because she's a close friend of my family, you know, and it was a cool, cool thing. And it's gone. It's gone. There's no trace of it at all. So to be able to write about that kind of stuff, to write history, which is what I would
I
love that stuff. It's so much more interesting to me than whether or not a ravioli tastes good, because you might think it tastes bad and your opinion has no more value or less value than mine.
Yeah.
I like that. It's kind of interesting. Like just, you and I have become good friends over the last couple of years, but like I just in gathering from this right now is you are a lot more artistic than I probably gathered initially, in the sense that like you definitely have more of a, I mean, you obviously feel that around Scout. I mean, that's definitely something that one of the things I really like about being a part of it and also reading about it. And I'm sure a lot of people do. So it's got a really nice, good artistic feel to it. It feels like someone's really, it's curated, which is nice.
Always have the travel section?
No.
And culture?
No, we were like, the culture section. Yeah. The travel section was just like, we should travel more.
Yeah.
And then, you know, every once in a while I go on a press trip and I think it was like, if I put a travel section in there, maybe people will ring my bell more and say, hey, do you want to go to Mexico? Yes. Like, yes, I do. Let's go. So yeah, perfect. That's it. I really like to travel. I like to share the experiences. I like to research places and get a feel for, I like to communicate that kind of stuff, you know? Yeah. Yeah. But if I could write about the stuff that I wanted to write about only all the time, I'd have a completely different, it would be like, I'd have like 3 visitors a month, you know, and 2 of them would be like relatives.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Well, and you guys also have a music, although it's quite small, there is a music component to the website as well.
Yeah.
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 Which I found really interesting.
Yeah. It's very small.
Do you know someone who was just on there that you know?
We do. Yeah. Shout out to Tristan Young.
Yeah. Yeah.
Co-host of my other podcast.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's
yeah.
on repeat. And a really, yeah. really, really intelligent man.
That was a good interview.
Music.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it's kind of funny because when I asked him to do the Definitive Records thing, I was like, hey, Tristan, like, I got the green light from Andrew. We can go ahead and do this.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, sweet. Awesome. And
no,
I was
no,
like,
he can, yeah.
And I was like, what do you want? And he's like, what do I need to do? I'm like, just pick 3 records, 3 songs, just write about them, you know, a little blurb.
And like
why
half
you like
an hour
them.
Later, he had it for
literally,
you.
Literally, like 3 hours later, full paragraphs, yeah. fully yeah. detailed. Like
he's passionate about
that's
music.
Good. And see, just, that kind of yeah. stuff is rare. Like to find
and also
people
having
like that.
What the brewers listen to, mm-hmm. what are their favorite jams?
Yeah,
which I read too, which I thought was super interesting.
Yeah,
because it has to be like music that everyone is okay with. Everybody,
right.
Go to
yeah,
go-to
soundtrack gear. Stuff is interesting. I like we did one called about 3 years ago, we added on, or 2 years ago, we added on a mapping component similar to Eater, where you can, it costs us a shit ton to introduce, but the value of it is such that you can really fiddle around with the physical space of Vancouver and have it be so that you can have stories in your hand, like the dishes. If you want to do the dishes is a feature where we ask somebody to take us out for breakfast, brunch, lunch, dinner, coffee, cocktails, and then they're naming all these places. And it's actually a physical map. It's kind of a cool thing. So we did one called the Atlas of Vancouver's Beer. And it you'd think that if anyone else did that, it would just be all these breweries that are around today. So you can walk around and go to all these breweries. But this is an Atlas of Vancouver Beer. So it's breweries that were open and closed 100 years ago. Like this is where it was.
Yeah, but I read that one.
That part of the... that's what sets us apart is that we value the past as much as we value the present. Cause we feel like a lot can be learned from the past. And we also feel like it's from a intellectual curiosity perspective. People really value discovering things about their own city. And a lot of our readers aren't from Vancouver. So everyone is in a race to learn about where they are. And as somebody who was born here, I love that every day, like just the other day, I would wait for our lexicons, the definition of local terms, Kokanee. Kokanee is a beer, right? And now everyone knows that it's sort of a cheap swill kind of lager beer. You know, it's not a big deal, but everyone knows that word. But if you take it to like Washington State or Montana or Tokyo, no one knows what is Coke. So that's like a perfect candidate for the lexicon. And I didn't know what it was. You know, Kokanee is an Okanagan First Nations word for a landlocked sockeye salmon. So they they didn't name the beer after the salmon.
They named it after the runoff of the mountains.
They named it after the glacier, which is named after the salmon.
Yeah.
But still, it's a beer named after a fish, and I think that's kind of rad that I didn't know that until yesterday. You know, as somebody who's from here, who's been saying
I didn't know that until right now, yeah, so it's right? perfect.
That's the whole point of that whole thing. Like, you can't make money from that, but still.
Yeah, ladies and gentlemen, your information of the day. You just learned something new.
Of the day. Yeah,
yeah. We're done. That's it. See you later. Bye. Thanks, Andrew.
Yeah.
That's why I like scouting. Cool. Actually, all those little interesting things that you wouldn't, and even in the in the restaurant graveyard, you highlight, you know, the main players and where they've gone on to mm-hmm. work since then. Mm-hmm. So that like detail is something I really enjoy. About
you always
Scout.
Try yeah. and connect to the present if you can. When you're trained as an historian, you always want to be able to synthesize material so that somebody who's reading it in the present has some frame of reference to understand what it is that you're talking about. And that's like, that's not formal historian training, but my favorite historians are always they're good communicators. They're able to get the information to you in a way in which you get it, even though the subject matter might be something that you've never come across before. Mm-hmm.
So you work with your wife?
Yeah.
She's your partner?
Yes.
How is that sometimes? Is that interesting or is that fun or is that... Because I've always been curious about that because like I've worked with my girlfriend and some days it's been very interesting.
You can't see because it's a podcast, right. But you should see the smirk on Jamie's face right after he asks that question.
And I'm not trying to poke fun. It's like, tell me arguments. But what I'm curious about is how do you guys view the website in different ways? And how do you guys curate it in your own way? Because I think it's really kind of a cool dynamic that you guys run it as a couple, but also, you know?
Well, I think it's important to note straight out of the gate that my wife is a lot smarter than me. And if you've ever met me and you've met her, you know who...
I can confirm this, by the way.
Yeah, that's a great answer.
She is a lot smarter than him.
Any time that I get to be with her or work with her, it's lucky for me and not the... Like, I married so out of my league. You know, she married down. I married up. Like, it's totally clear. Anyone who spends any time with us or has ever spent any time with us would totally concur and be like, yep. Like, I'm a short, pudgy, not attractive dude with glasses with like a bum leg and, you know, I'm pretty shitty. She's amazing. She's like totally, she's beautiful. She's elegant. She's wicked smart. And she is super loving and tolerant and patient. And she's not snobby. She's, you know, she's friendly. She always cares about how the other person feels before she cares about herself. Any of her friends will attest to that. Anyone who knows me and compare the two of us knows that Scout wouldn't be what it is without her daily input. Like she's fucking amazing. I lucked out. So part of the reason why that relationship is successful or that the business relationship is successful is because I defer to her and her intelligence on most things.
Do you guys have things that she does and you guys just kind of...
Yeah, so I'm the editor. So whatever she writes the Scout list and that lands on my desk just as your stuff lands on my desk and I have to edit it. And editing your wife is no fun. But we've got a rhythm and you know, I don't have to edit much, if at all. Like, she's got her own voice. And sometimes I help just whittle that voice down to, you know, sometimes, like all writers, we go on explanation safari where we go a little bit long. And just as you do.
I know. Yeah, you've done that to me.
Yeah, I'm
fine with that.
So. I'll dial it back a little bit. But, you know, the business relationship is such that when I say that we're a kitchen table business, we've had an office in the past, but we gave it up because it's like, why would we not just save the money? So we wake up and, you know, the dog gets walked, the kids go off to school, and we sit down at our kitchen table and we just bust out the day's material. You know, she handles the business side of Scout she does the Scout list, which is, I think she's at 508 Scout lists over the years now. And that's basically
what's happening in the city.
That's what's happening in the city. And it's always some weird shit.
Does she always go out and find that stuff, or do people come to her with that information?
A little mix of both, but that she has a natural curiosity as to what's going on in the city. You know, she's a Vancouverite too. Like, she's always been here. And
it's actually funny. That's the Scout list is where I found out about the first annual podcast convention.
Yeah,
for someone who does a podcast,
that's
I was like, "What the fuck?"
Yeah, that's awesome.
I found out about it on the street. So I was walking down the street and I saw like a placard for it, and I was just like, "What?" And it was like happening in like 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And I was like,
next year.
Yeah, she's very much been the engine that has driven Scout. Like when I had Urban Diner. And we floated, when I floated the idea of let's, you know, could we do something that was more, you know, not just food? And she was like, dude, yes, totally. And she, like, it was hard, like giving to have a successful thing like Urban Diner and then to, you know, to give it up and start something fresh. Like I remember having a conversation with one really powerful person in public relations. She told me that at the time that I was out of my mind. Like, I floated, like, what do you think of this idea? And she's like, you're fucking crazy. Like, why would you do that? You're insane. Stick with what you got. It's like not even peaked yet. Like, just go for it. And I was gratifying, you know, to see Urban Diner sort of just, you know, gone. And Scout was a success from the day it started. Like, we didn't care about revenue. For the first year, we were like, just, it'll happen. just stick to your values and stick to the product and just keep working, put your nose to the grindstone and just dig in and produce. And never once, we don't do cold calls. We don't call somebody and say, hey, would you like to advertise? Or hey, would you like to become a member of the Scout community? It's always people knocking on our door. And I think that's appreciated. And certainly we don't have the bodies to take those, to make those calls. And we also feel it would be a little bit unscouty, you know, to cold call people and say, give us money.
Mm. Who would you call anyways?
Real estate.
I'm sure you know a lot of people you could call for money.
Real estate, straight up. I call like the biggest construction companies and real estate marketing companies and say, I want to sell your building.
Yeah.
All Ian Gillespie.
Front page.
Yeah.
Getting Ian Gillespie on
Bob
there.
Bob Rennie.
Yeah. Ugh, Ian Gillespie. God.
Yeah. West Bank.
Yeah.
I got lots of money.
I have a lot of hashtag ideas for you.
That's fun. So last question, and I figured that I thought this would be kind of fun. I'm hoping you'll do it. So you just talked about this. You briefly mentioned that you do the dishes.
Yeah.
But you've never done the dishes.
No, I've never done the dishes.
I'm going to ask you some of the dishes questions. And
yes.
Do it. Yeah. Ask me about my albums too. Like, please, let's throw down. If we're going to do this, I've always, when I'm producing these, it's like,
I want to do one.
Yeah. You want to know my top three albums?
Okay.
Yeah.
Somebody ask me.
We'll do a round table here. Okay, Andrew, you can go first. Definitive albums.
I'll go last. You guys knock yourself out.
Oh, definitive albums?
Yeah. Albums. Most that have had the biggest influence on you and your taste in music.
Björk Post, 1995 for me. It was my first.
You have to have named three.
Well, I can name three?
Yeah.
Björk Post, Portishead, their second album.
Portishead? Really?
Yeah, because it was, you know, it's like I was in high school when I was that age.
The live track.
Electronic music was, and my brother had all these CDs like Future Sound of London, Massive Attack, all that stuff. So it really shaped my musical taste. Mm-hmm. Moving forward into like electronic music, which is the whole London scene, right? Third one, it's really hard on the spot like that.
See, look at his face.
Oh. I'm already, this is why I want to go last. I wanted to.
Yeah, I'm going to go more like, I'm not going to go like historically, like all the greatest albums of like the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
No, but these are the ones that have the greatest influence on you.
Yeah, so.
That have basically, they're foundational in your taste of music. So
yeah.
It could be recent, like shit
yeah,
changes.
I would say Blind Pilot's first album, Three Rounds in a Sound, because it really made me really love indie folk rock and like really like eclectic indie folk rock. Those would be my three, I think.
Interesting.
Off the top of my head, though.
Now you, Jamie.
I was going to say Smashing Pumpkins,
yeah,
for sure.
90, yeah, Smashing Pumpkins. Sammy Stream, by far.
That's a good
probably
one.
The most indelible album I've ever listened to. Black Rebel Motorcycle Club's Howl from 2005.
Great record.
Gosh, you guys are such babies.
That's like one of my favorites.
You say Louis Armstrong.
Yeah.
Louis Armstrong's greatest hits.
Yeah.
And then, what's the next one? I'm probably actually going to go recent. I'd probably go the OC's most recent album.
You love the OC's, yeah.
Their most recent album I really like.
Yeah, respect. Like that.
I can't remember what the album's name off the top of my head right now, but here, let me pull it up right now. I know all the songs, but yeah, I was like obsessed with this album this year.
This year?
Yeah.
Your taste in music is so in flux.
Well, I mean, like,
I have milk older than your. Jeez.
No, because I went old and I went kind of new and then I went kind of everything. And yeah, I'm trying to remember it.
Well, I'm really interested to hear yours. Because you're, people don't know, but you're a huge music fan as well.
I am. I'm
all over the place.
My parents had this insane musical taste, everything from opera to.
Yeah.
You know, there are a few things that are my own, like punk and hip hop and stuff. But so for me, it would be. Without a doubt, the most important album in my life is this so cliche, but 1973's Dark Side of the Moon by Pink Floyd.
Sure.
Not a bad one.
Because I still listen to it at least once a week. I just listen to it if I'm flying, because I'm terrified of flying. If I could be drugged and out cold, I would.
My roommate used to fall asleep.
So I will go to sleep. I will not go to sleep, but I'll relax myself listening to Us and Them.
Mm-hmm.
On Dark Side of the Moon. And there are lyrics on that that have been like, that have gotten me through. Like when my father died, there was, I listened to a totally different record, but Pink Floyd, Wish You Were Here, Shine On You Crazy Diamond.
Yeah.
You know, and just about knowing myself and knowing that, you know, my relationship with my father, my family's English. So Pink Floyd has always been this connection to, and my father went to a private school and like a boarding school. And so
you lived that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I went to a boarding school or private schools. And so there's this connection that I have to it. So there are lyrics like that get me through life and stuff. And I think that's been a huge impact on me. Like there's this one lyric.
That's like one of the best albums.
Hanging on in quiet desperation is the English way.
Yeah.
Like that to me is like, hanging on in quiet desperation is the English way. It's such a, to me, like it speaks to the ethos of that I was raised in. So Dark Side of the Moon, totally lane change here. It takes a nation of millions to hold us back.
Wow.
By Public Enemy.
Wow. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Really?
So
you like that more than Fear of a Black Planet?
Yes.
Oh,
well, it's about the foundations of my taste. So that was a gateway drug into so many other. It was the first, like before that, I was aware of Run DMC and, you know, like this was the era of, you know, Kool Moe Dee and Two Live Crew. And, you know, this is the beginnings of the Beastie Boys. And this is pre NWA, but this is
mid-80s, yeah.
When hip hop to me had a message, like Chuck D was like political.
Oh,
there was this one lyric. It was like, I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it. It said they were suckers. They wanted me for their army or whatever. Picture me giving a damn. I said, never. Now, when I first heard that, I was like, fuck yeah, that's so rad. So I was like, I was young. And then, so the third one, I don't want to take too much time on that, would be Hatful of Hollow by the Smiths.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Great album.
Which is a weird nice choice. But that's like when I loved a girl when I was 16 and she wanted nothing to do with me. And I had Morrissey as my consolation. It's the sappiest thing ever. But like there were so many of his lyrics were like, I got it. Like having to go to work in the rain and stuff like just. I was looking for a job and then I found a job and heaven knows I'm miserable now. Like it just made so much sense to me at the time so it taught me to, you know, all those bands and those different foundational times and music taught me to go beyond the melody and just listen to lyrics and let them in a little bit. Yeah. Let them into your head. When music can get into your head and become part of your life, I think that's more valuable than what can make you tap your toes.
Absolutely.
And dance.
And his singing style was so unique and so captivating also.
Totally.
I love the Smiths a lot.
Yeah, and very emblematic of a time in Great Britain. It was just such a fucking mess. Yeah. You know. So for me, it...
Post-punk.
Yeah. Well, for restaurants, The Dishes.
Yes, okay, so The Dishes. Okay, so breakfast.
Fuck. Dude.
I've never heard of it.
I don't know. I would do... Yeah. I would do the same dish at two places because there's a version of this dish and the same. There's Shambar and Cafe Medina.
Oh, they, so
the what do you call it? Short rib apples, applewood smoked cheddar, balsamic onions, bacon.
Okay.
What do they call it? Fricassee. Short rib fricassee. That shit's amazing. And they got good coffee at both places. So I'd split. I'd go between Shambar and Medina. Yeah.
Okay. Lunch.
Lunch. Ramen butcher. Get the classic. No mushrooms. Add corn and a spice of red garlic paste.
Oh, I like the black there more. Black's pretty good.
It is good. Yeah. It is. But I really like the noodles and I like the broth.
Good around the corner from my house.
Happy hour.
Happy hour's next.
Pigeon. I think they've got one of the better happy hours in town.
Why? What do they do there?
I don't know. They just make good food and cheap drinks. I think you can get Negronis there for cheap and
I've heard this before. You're not the Wesley first person to tell me this.
You know what? Pigeon is one of those restaurants that
like, kind of flies under the radar for a lot.
It's gotten so much better. Not so much better, but it's just gotten progressively better and better. Like that's rare. Usually a restaurant in its first year is the best expression of what that restaurant is going to be. And then there are places that just keep getting better. And Pigeon keeps getting better. It's never been a bad restaurant or anything. Like I can't fault it for anything. But every time I eat there, I'm more impressed with what they do. I love that place.
I feel that way about the Union. I feel like the Union's gotten better since they've been around. So I like to go there for brunch because it's just right around the corner from my house. But I like every time I go there, it's just like just everything, the food's better.
That's good to have that kind of thing in your bag, you know, like where it's in your golf bag, like that kind of club where it's your go-to and it never disappoints you.
Yeah. Okay. So then next would be dinner.
I go highs. Like if I got my choice of anything, highs to me is a dining experience.
Highs.
Well, I'm an alien. Like dining out has been ruined for me. Like I'm not a normal person when it comes to restaurants. Yeah, like I cannot go to a restaurant and have a normal experience. So I'm always fretting. I have anxiety. Like I don't enjoy like.
Do people like freak out like when you come into a restaurant? Like,
oh, no, I don't think so. Maybe sometimes people do if they don't know me and they think that there's a potential that I'm a total dick or something like that. Or they're dealing with influencers and ask like I insist on paying for my own food. You know, I don't want to deal or anything.
You go
like
for chat a comfort?
Oh yeah, lots of times. Yeah. And you know, there's a back and forth. If people are like, no, I totally insist, I'll be like, hey dude, that's on you. Fine. But I'll never call ahead and I don't make reservations unless I feel like shit. If I don't make a reservation, I'm not going to get a table, but I'll often do it in a different name if, you know, but you know, if going to highs, they don't give a shit who I am, you know, they don't know who I am, you know, and if they did, they wouldn't care. And if the experience is going to be the same that day as it was, you know, 30 years ago, and the food's going to be consistently good. It's expensive, you know, whatever, but I want to treat myself on occasion, and that's where I would go if money was no object, and you know, I'd go there. Okay. Like hands down.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
We're going to go late night cocktails.
Oh, dude.
So many options.
Yeah. I don't know. I like there are seats that I like.
Oh, does
that
be cocktails?
That seat. It can be, if I can score like,
it doesn't be cocktails, me beer or whatever, go for late night drinks, whatever.
I would do Laboratoire, you know, but then again, there are certain bartenders. Like if I was guaranteed to one-on-one, you know, facing a bartender, like I love whatever Ingram's doing, Katie, you know, like I love what, if I can get Sean Layton to make me a cocktail at Como, I'd be pretty stoked, but he's pretty busy. doing other stuff.
That's why that's
right. You know, I'm kind of living in the past there, but
that's why I like going out to Juniper, because Max Borman always takes
care. Yeah. So yeah. Like there are places like that, you know, that I'd love to go to and just chat with the person. Maybe I'm not like the best candidate because I'm an alien when it comes to eating out. It's a totally different experience for me. There are many times that I wish, like almost every week, that I wish that I could just go back in time and you know, have a normal restaurant experience. It's not external pressures. Like it's all in my head. Like when I go,
like you're saying you know too much.
It's not that I know too much. It's that I fixate on things that other people won't fixate. Okay. And if you work in the restaurant business, you know what I mean. You go into a restaurant, right? So now imagine having no restaurant experience, how much you'd be freed up to just...
When a new restaurant opens up, the first thing I always do when I walk in is like, oh, I do this differently. Oh, I like what they did here. Oh, yeah. Interesting.
So, but I can
I'm not thinking about the experience.
The vast majority of people go into restaurants thinking in something complete. They don't even consider half the shit that we consider.
Yeah. I was pissed off when the Union opened because my ex-girlfriend at the time had lived in the building next door. I remember walking and seeing that space and I was like, oh, that's such a great space. I'd love to put a restaurant in there. And then when they opened, I was like, fuck you. Yeah. And I was like kind of angry at them, but I was like, why am I mad at these people? I'm not like, where am I? I'm not opening a restaurant.
Yeah.
But they'd opened it and they'd done such a good job at it. And I was like, oh, I was like kind of irritated that they just did
this. I'm resentful of anybody that replaces a restaurant that I like that closed. You know, I like whatever the German restaurant that replaced Bonita.
Yeah, Bauhaus.
Yeah, Bauhaus. Now, it's not really like that guy makes it easy to not want to go to that restaurant.
He's a dink.
But says you, I don't want to get sued, but you know, like he did a lot of stuff like filming his restaurant reviews as he was going around town before he opened. Like, hey, Wildebeest, it's not that great.
No, he's an asshole because he condemns all these other restaurants saying that I'm trying to elevate Vancouver dining.
That's
and
classic
it's like,
US
no,
politics.
It's, okay, you have a viewpoint. You want to come across and do something different. Great. Mm. That's awesome. You have every right to do that. But why do you have to go around bashing
shit on
everyone else who works hard at what they do?
Yeah.
Like, who are you? Like, you come, you're a foreigner in this city and like, don't be an asshole.
Yeah.
No, you're not, you know, this is a small community. Don't fuck everyone around.
Yeah. Well, I still would find it difficult to go there. And not because of that, but because of what it used to be. When my father passed away, my brother and I had a wake in Bonita, just the two of us in a corner. I told Neil and Mark, my dad just died. I'm going to come in for 30 minutes and put us in a corner and leave a bottle at the table. And we just went to town when we went there. So that real estate has it. That piece of ground is kind of hallowed for me. And so is like where Cafe Barney is on Main Street. That used to be Monsoon. That was, yeah. I used to just love that place. Yeah. No, like you can imagine if like when whatever replaces Gyoza King, people are going to be like, I'm not going to set foot in that place. So I'm still subject to the impulses of regular non-restaurant people. You know, I'm slave to memory. I like to see those things protected, but oh well.
Well, to piggyback on the doing the dishes, mm-hmm. I want to add favorite brewery at the moment.
Oh, good question.
Do you drink, beer?
Of course I drink beer. I'm a professional drinker.
For me, this is easy. This is like, this,
right.
Well, Strathcona Brewery is right around the corner from my house.
Okay.
And I like that they have let other breweries, other brewers take over and you know, play around with their equipment and make new things. And
Superflux,
that's
their stuff there. Yeah. Superflux, they have their stuff there. And, you know, I think they're on the route to doing their own thing. But I appreciate that. And I also, they're, you know, the people who manage the brand have been skateboarders. And, you know, so I kind of feel a kinship with that. but then also...
Brass Neck is...
It is awesome. I'll get there. But they do a pizza at... they do really good pizza mm-hmm. at Strathcona Brewing or Beer Company. They do one of my favorite pizzas city there. So, and it's like I said,
You wrote about it. I remember you did that.
Literally right around the corner from my house. So I'll go there as often as I'm allowed.
Hmm.
And then Brass Neck would be right up there too, just because it feels so natural and like it's been there forever and like it should be there. You know, it feels institutional. It feels, and not in an oppressive way, but like it's part of the fabric of the community. I really like that. I really like Nigel. I like the whole crew there. You know, it just feels like it's the brewery of the industry. Like if you've been in this game a long time and you saw how it came about and you saw how Vancouver's brewing scene all sort of flourished, and the Alibi Room was an incubator for that. You know, people would go and they'd sit and they'd plan breweries and, you know, their finances on the backs of beer soaked napkins. So that place has got
and he's got his new place coming up too.
That's right. Yeah.
Magnet
on Tender. That's going to be an interesting block.
That's basically going to be like Alibi 2.0 basically kind of idea.
I don't think he would see it like that. But I think that it's whether he likes it or not, people are gonna think of it like that. It's gonna be lots of beer, great food, convivial neighborhood atmosphere, and him, you know. So and the crew that he puts together, it's gonna be like the Alibi.
Gonna have that feel to it.
Yeah,
It's an interesting.
It's
location.
On Pender between I don't know. It's like just up by Victory Square on the same block as Finch's and
it's an interesting location. It's like great downtown, great walkable space.
It's been an iffy location historically.
That's what I was going to say.
But I think that's going to be... See, when a place like that he could open a place...
Well, anyway.
Anywhere. It's the same approach that Vikram took. You know, if the rent... Or Sean Heather would take. Like, if the lease is good, then trust me, I'll do fine. Yeah. I've exhausted myself.
Anything you want to plug?
We're expanding this year.
Yeah, you.
I'm gonna say that we're going to go into the islands of the West Coast. We're gonna have a new website that's dedicated to Victoria and Tofino and the Gulf Islands and Cowichan Valley.
Oh wow!
Very exciting.
So I was raised partly in Victoria, so that's always like though I was born in Vancouver, Victoria in my heart is my hometown.
Okay.
Oddly, like I guess when you go to high, that's where I went to high school. That's where I got kicked out of several high schools.
Yeah. That's that skateboarder.
Where did this idea come from?
To go back to...
Just to expand.
To expand. Well, we cover the islands already on Scout, but there's so much is happening in
I've noticed that Victoria over the last year or so, your presence has grown. You've been writing a lot more about stuff out there. I've noticed that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it hasn't been like a run up and trying to bank content or anything. It's just because the scene there is just where it's on the up and up. And I'm super excited, like, because I'm a homeboy. Like, I if shit's happening in my old hometown, I'm super thrilled and excited. And
is it going to be under the same name or?
It's going to be under a different name, but it's going to be umbilically connected. So
similar.
Same media company, but different name and. similar content. It's awesome. Going to be basically, you could say it's Scout, but for the islands.
Are you looking to launch this soon, or?
It'll be done by summer. If all our ducks are in a row, it'll be launching this summer.
There you go.
Super cool.
We've got some breaking news here.
Breaking news.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
Do we have a name?
I will. We're locking TVA? That down. Okay. But it's a rad name.
Okay.
I love the name. And we're just making sure that we own it for sure.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's amazing. Got some breaking news for anybody out there who lives on the islands. We got some. I guess you're going to have some.
Coming home, baby.
You're going to have some. Yeah, we're going to have some more content. And you're going to have someone who's going to be excited to promote anything out there. Yeah, Andrew, this has been great. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much.
We are very excited to talk Vancouver, talk Scouts, and talk about the media industry and a lot of things out there. Do check out Scout Magazine. It's scoutsmagazine.ca.
Yeah.
Yep.
You can find some of my stuff on there. Obviously, Andrew, everything is about him on there, and his wife, Michelle, who's way smarter than him. Mm-hmm. Shout outs to her.
Agreed.
Michelle. And thank you, Andrew, and we'll see you another day.